More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we like to call it, real debate without the hate. Hi, I'm Kevin Kelton. I'm a political activist and a moderate Democrat from Los Angeles, California.
I'm DJ McGuire. I'm an economics instructor, a cost estimator, a veteran Republican activist until last year, and a rookie Democratic activist as of this month from Suffolk, Virginia.
I'm Helena Henry, an evangelical Christian conservative or moderate and lawyer from Colleyville, Texas.
Hi, I'm Greg Matuszak, a liberal Democrat and veteran of many political campaigns from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hello, I'm Molly Malloy Cooper, a senior lecturer from The Ohio State University, living in Columbus, Ohio, and I am a free market conservative.
And the More Perfect Union can be found on iTunes, iHeartRadio, YouTube, Facebook, and at our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com, where you can also find host bios and commentary. This week, we are featuring a commentary by journalist William Gleed, who tells us about his trip into the Boston protest that happened yesterday to see if he could actually spot a real-life Nazi. So you'll want to read that. It's actually kind of humorous. Let's start very briefly with yesterday's protest. I assume that everybody saw a little bit of it on television. Obviously, the people who were anti-fascist, if you want to use that label, were the ones that turned out in greater numbers. Did we learn anything from that protest, or was it just a blip on the map?
We learned that Boston handles these things very well. And it was what I would expect. I mean, Boston being a very liberal area, so that they were well outnumbered, especially in light of what went down last week. I was just happy to see that there was relatively little violence.
Yeah, and I would also give credit to, you know, Dallas and New Orleans and some of the other cities that participated. My understanding is they didn't have the same numbers as Boston, but they've certainly learned from past mistakes in terms of setting up barricades to prevent fans and cars from coming in and things like that. And Dallas in particular was prepared to manage altercations between citizens and the police effectively. So I think, you know, a round of applause.
And for police departments that handled this very well this past week. Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
That they did. Although a brief defense of the Charlottesville Police Department, which has been taking it on the chin lately, as I understand it from, and I have a friend who lives in the Charlottesville area, the local authorities in Charlottesville had actually worked something out with the Confederate flag folks that their demonstration would start at noon and they would enter the park through a particular entrance. And apparently the Nazis and the supremacists and all the other yahoos basically broke all of those rules and
what?
Came to the park from everywhere 3 hours early.
Yes. What?
Yeah, you're shocked.
I'm shocked. I can imagine. I'm shocked that Nazis can't be trusted to follow the rules.
Tell me about it.
And I know I know this sounds funny and I'm trying to be light about it, but that Nazis are, I'm going to swear, Nazis are assholes is something that should
You know what? It's not all Nazis. It's just millennial Nazis. There's a difference.
Nazis are dishonest. Quelle surprise. The Charlottesville Police Department the Charlottesville authorities may have been a bit naive about what they were dealing with, but it was not a matter of, you know, had the rules been followed, there would have been less violence in Charlottesville. Of course, the rules aren't followed because there were Nazis involved.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, DJ, but wasn't there also an issue whereby the police did have a plan, but that plan was undone by by court rulings about them having to allow access to both groups in the same place where they could hear each other and things like that?
That's the claim. I'm not really sure that claim holds because the city initially there was a plan A. The city tried to implement a plan B. The plan B got overruled. I don't necessarily see why that invalidates plan A. So it's possible that might have been an issue. But again, I think the impression that I get is had the Nazis followed the rules, and of course Nazis don't follow rules, but had they followed
Nazis
the rules,
are the
it would have been
worst.
Less of an issue.
Yeah, I mean, and to be quite honest, in I'm going to use my middle America, the Midwest, Ohio, I'm not hearing a lot of blowback on the police. I mean, yeah, even in Cincinnati, Ohio, I'm hearing who's to blame. It is Nazis. Nazis are horrible people.
Wait a second. Let's not let the KKK people off the hook on this.
All of them. They are
white supremacists, white nationalists, skinheads, neo-Nazis.
All these people are the worst of the worst. And by the way, anybody who said, hey, you know what? I think I'm a history buff. I think I just want to, you know, go preserve a statue. Huh. Am I walking under a Nazi? I guess I am. You know what you are? Anyone who walks under a Nazi flag you know what you are? You're a Nazi.
Yes. If you're walking next to people that are yelling, Jews will not replace us, if you're walking next to people who are saying anything negative about blacks or any other minority, you kind of are stuck with that.
Right. Jeff Foxworthy did a whole bit on this. You know what you are? You know, you just might be a Nazi. Yeah.
You may be a Nazi.
Be a Nazi if. Yeah, this is the whole thing. And I don't want Jeff Foxworthy to sue me because I think he's pretty cool and all. But if you ever, you know, these guys are scumbags. And if you say, you know, I think I'm just going to see what happens if I just, you know, hang out with these guys. You're a Nazi.
I take it thus and therefore that none of us would agree with the president, who stated on Tuesday that there were some, quote, very fine people with the tiki torches on Friday night and as part of the initial protests on Saturday. So putting that to one side, the fact of the matter is about two-thirds of self-identified Republicans do agree and they approve of Trump's reaction to Charlottesville. They approve of what he did on Tuesday. And, you know, for me, I'm still waiting for the part where being a conservative Democrat will be hard. I kept being told that would be a very difficult thing to do. It hasn't happened to me yet. Sorry. But the question is, what does this say about the Republican Party that more of them are willing to say, yes, standing up with Nazis is better for me than repealing Obamacare, which only got one-third approval from Republicans. What does it say about the Republican Party? Helena and Molly.
So I'll say this. I don't think Republicans view it that way. And I'm going to make some gross generalizations about the Republican base that are probably unfair. But I believe there's a tremendous amount of apathy and ignorance in the Republican electorate. I don't think that people who identify as Republicans and who support Trump to this day consider themselves to be racist. There's, you know, debate whether there's a lot of latent racism going on there. They're not particularly informed, and their worldview is really consumed by their lives and their families and whatever it is they have going on for them, whether it be soccer practice or you know, trouble paying their bills or whatever it might be. And so it's very easy to discount and dismiss the severity of Trump's appalling, inexcusable behavior because they're just not aware of it. So I think that there's a fair number of individuals who could be characterized that way that make up some of the two-thirds support that he's getting from Republicans. That being said, I do think that it's Republicans or individuals who identify as Republican, Molly and myself, I wouldn't say I identify as Republican, but, and I won't speak for Molly, anyone who identifies as a Republican.
But wait, I'll interrupt. You do identify yourself as a conservative, though.
Yeah. And so here's, not to make this a Helena show, but here's what this episode did for me this week, this Trump press conference, and what I hope it does for people who identify as conservatives or Republicans or anything left of or right of center everywhere. It forced me to ask, what do I really believe and why do I believe it? Why do I call myself a conservative? Personally, I call myself a conservative because I think the Constitution should be read in a way that is textual in nature and, you know, adheres to sort of the originalist viewpoints that Gorsuch and Scalia and some other conservative Supreme Justices have put forth. There's a lot of reasons for that. I won't get into it, but the summary of it is, it's just as dangerous to have activist judges on the left as it is on the right. You end up with a Korematsu or you end up with a Trump administration. When you have a government that's out of control, those entities can become a lot more powerful. That being said, there's really nothing that I see in the Republican Party today that, or very little I see today, other than abortion, that I can really get behind and subscribe to. And so my point is, I would hope that of the two-thirds, of the one-thirds, of, you know, the Paul Ryans and the McConnells and the Jeff Flakes, that everyone is taking a good long look at what it is they think they mean when they say I'm a conservative.
Well, the other thing I would say just quickly is the one thing that I am hoping, and obviously as a conservative Democrat, I would want to see this, is the separation from conservative and Republican. You can be one without necessarily being the other.
Right.
And I right. think Democrats in particular need to recognize what is going on and realize that when it comes to building out their coalition into a majority coalition, which it is not right now, 2016 proved that, that we need to look more towards conservatives. I would look more particularly towards economic conservatives, but also some social conservatives as well, and say, where can we find common ground with these folks? Where can we show them that their values are, in fact, our values, whatever our disagreements on methods? Where can we find perhaps agreements with them and build bridges on methods so that they can be part of our coalition moving forward? It was none other than Jesse Jackson in 1988 who said, whether you're a hawk or a dove, you're still a bird. You need a left wing and a right wing to fly. And Democrats have been trying to fly without a right wing for many, many years, and it's not working. So I look forward
and
to helping build the conservative wing feather
Tom,
by feather.
Tom Perez, head of the DNC, a lot of folks in the DNC, they're making it worse. They're doubling down on the litmus tests. They're refusing
to be fair, Helena, before you jump in, Kevin, I have been in politics long enough. I've spent far too much of my life in this, but I have spent enough of my life to know that the DNC or RNC chairman does not necessarily speak for the party, and the DNC and RNC leadership does not necessarily speak for the party. The person who will speak for the Democrats will be whoever is nominated in 2020, and that's going to be where the Democrats really need to sort out what they are doing in terms of building out their coalition. Tom Perez saying nutty things, it's unfortunate, but it's not a deal breaker, because we don't treat party leaders the same way the rest of the world treats party leaders. We think we can ignore them, and frankly, we're right.
Right.
Yeah, I totally agree. I wouldn't agree with the nutty part, because I don't think what he says is nutty. But I totally agree that whether it was Reince Priebus or Howard Dean or Michael Steele, thank you, or Tom Perez, the people running the parties are not the leaders of the party. They are functionaries.
No, I would call Tom Perez at this point a fundraiser. Potato, potato. He's got me on speed dial at this point to ask me for money. And I get like 7 emails from me. He calls me Greg personally.
What am I doing wrong? Because I get none of these emails. I swear to you.
Oh, you're kidding.
People tell me all the time. They say, I'm sure you got this email that I just got. I get none of them.
Oh, my gosh. I will. First of all.
Kevin.
Now you will. I will sign you up for the newsletter. I'm signing DJ up, by the way. He thinks it's easy.
It's going to be hard for him to be a conservative Democrat.
So I want to build on something DJ was talking about, because DJ, you said, where can Democrats find common ground with conservatives, and who can we reach out to build that common ground? And there is one person who actually shared a value that Democrats hold very dear that we could have reached out to and still can reach out to, because like Democrats, he wants to raise taxes on the rich. And you know who that person is? I know you all do. Steve Bannon.
Yeah.
Steve Bannon.
Yeah. No, that was actually something that I, yeah.
So irony of irony, the one guy that we could have reached out to just lost his Washington power base this week. Doesn't mean he has no power base, but I thought that was kind of amusing.
Are you kidding? Steve Bannon is like a Sith Lord.
If you
strike him down, he becomes more powerful. In fact, he started to look like
Palpatine.
What's his name?
Palpatine.
Yeah, Palpatine. Thank you, Palpatine. He started to decompose. He is now more powerful that he has been kicked out. I mean, the decompose.
Well, we'll see about that, because when I heard that Bannon was being booted, my reaction was, the one thing that he could have helped us on, which is tax reform. Now he's not there to do that.
But he still, what was his quote? He's like, now I have all my weapons with me. He is now going to be.
Well, he's just patting himself because
he's not.
Listen, he got slapped down. He got bitch slapped, excuse my French, by General Kelly. And he's just trying to save face. And he'll go back to Breitbart and he'll be the editor in chief. Breitbart is not going to be any more powerful than it was last week.
And I disagree. I think he will whip that thing.
Breitbart is surprisingly influential. I mean,
right,
I don't get
on
it.
On the far
but,
right,
but they are.
They are, but they're not going to be any more powerful with
no,
him back.
No, but I mean, like, but I mean, overall, like, you know, just in terms of number, I mean, it's surprising because I think they've really are, you know, a shell of what they were under Andrew Breitbart.
Well, I'm curious. Let me ask you about that, Molly, and then I want to also ask Helena the same question. Do you guys analogize Breitbart to Media Matters or to HuffPost or to Dell?
I do now, but I did not under Andrew Breitbart.
You analogize it now?
But yes, I do.
I consider Breitbart to be more extreme than HuffPost, personally.
Yeah, that's what I think. That's why I wanted to ask.
Yeah. I would say more than HuffPo, probably about with Media Matters.
I would agree with Media Matters, but I don't even – like, I'll read HuffPo style and entertainment, but I know that if I'm reading something HuffPo politics, it's pretty biased.
Yeah.
And I right. know that if I'm reading it, I'll be like, this is bubblegum. I'm enjoying this, and this is for me. But I know where it's coming from, and I know it's a sugary snack and bad for me because it can't be trusted. But I know
and you can't use it to sway anyone that doesn't feel exactly the same
right.
way you
I'll,
do. And
I'll never use it in an argument, you know, like on Open Fire, which you can find us all there. I'll never use – that's a plug. I'll never use it to say – to prove a point and say, hey, here's a HuffPo article because I'll be laughed out. It's a joke, you know.
Open Fire Politics, FB, Facebook. Go ahead.
Okay. So I wanted to get – I never did get to answer about whether – you know, so I really should have interrupted you there. But anyway, about the you know, and actually that's what I was going to say is part of the reason why two-thirds liked it is the takeaway for them was I'm not finished yet fake news. So they approved of him beating up on the media. They love that. And then the other is that there are negative feelings towards the Antifa groups and kind of going back to what was kind of perceived as anti-cop sentiment that, you know, kind of helped carry him in the 2016 election. So, but again, a lot of that is as Helena said, kind of apathy and not really being aware of what actually went down on Friday. And I'm certainly in the one third that didn't agree with.
Yeah. And let's talk about what the Antifa means. I'm not sure that the people who oppose that group even knew what that term was before 2 weeks ago, you know? So I think some of this is allowing whatever entity is opposing Trump to be sort of a stand-in for everything that a certain segment of the population hates, whether it be Black Lives Matter or those who identify issues with police forces in the country, things like that. And I kind of bristle against the notion that there's something really concrete about the Antifa that justifies the
backlash. Well, I still have many of my former Republican acquaintances on social media, and I track their what they put on their profiles and their news feeds and such. And to get an idea of what they are thinking, I think there was one guy at the counter protest in Charlottesville who carried a Soviet flag. Now, frankly, that is effing stupid from my perspective. But I have to say, I saw that one Soviet flag from my Republican friends more often than I saw every other counter-protester combined. It's as if he was the only guy who was there. And I think what is happening is for a lot of folks on the right who don't want to tell themselves that they support Trump and don't want to tell everybody else they support Trump, they're falling into what I think Jonah Goldberg created, they're falling into anti-Trumpism. They are seizing upon Trump opponents who are extreme. They're saying, these people represent all Trump opponents and we are against them. Anti-Trumpism is rampant on the right, and it is causing some very serious distortions. Just getting back to what Kevin said, though.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Helena. I just want to just
get I think that's right.
Helena. I'll get my point later. My other point later.
Sorry. Yeah, sorry. Well, just real quick to add on those distortions, Dinesh D'Souza, I didn't even know he was out of prison, but Dinesh D'Souza gave
me No, I'm going to interrupt. You have to refer to him as convicted felon, Dinesh D'Souza. I mean, every time. Please, he has to be convicted.
Greg, I believe the
felon.
Reference where she said she didn't know he was out of prison. Checks the mail.
No, but
checks
the box on that. We you have to always.
I'm
everyone, please,
I'm big on repentance and forgiveness. Right. It's a Christian thing.
Not me. But, not for that scumbag.
But he gave an interview.
Greg, is this shaping your opinion on whether felons should vote?
No.
Okay, let's felon, okay, hang on, that's everybody. True. Helena, what did former inmate 46712 actually say?
I'm sorry, Dinesh. I do like the idea of people being able to move past their past, but I guess he won't have that opportunity. Anyway, he went on some interview. I can't remember with whom he was speaking, and essentially put forth the argument that Nazism and fascism and all the things that we hate and that we're you know, stringing and lynching this week are products of the left. And his argument, not mine, his argument was that these forces, when you look at the spectrum, really were extensions of policies that came out of FDR and things like that. Mussolini was a fan. Hitler, to some strange extent, allegedly was a fan. And it is only post-flip that we started to align fascism with the right.
No.
When I say flip, I mean the civil rights. Yeah, yeah. I completely disagree. I, yeah. But when you talked about distortions, I said, one thing we got to talk about is the distortions coming out of Dinesh D'Souza's
mouth. Yes, and that clearly is a distortion because it does not take into account. And to be fair, most Americans
he doesn't
don't.
Mention that. He doesn't mention the flip, I should note.
No, of course not. Of course he wouldn't. Of course he wouldn't. I've seen this on the right, too. Where they tell themselves that the National Socialist German Workers' Party, they focus on the socialists and they forget everything else in the party name. And I can understand that, but it doesn't change the fact that when the rise of the German right really came into fore, which I would say would be in reaction to the Young Referendum of 1929, which was the referendum put for those who don't know, which would be just about everybody, because even I just stumbled upon it recently. It was a referendum put to the German people to reject war reparations for World War I. And it was fueled by Alfred Hugenberg, who was a press baron and a hard right-wing monarchist in Germany. And that really was the campaign where Adolf Hitler was embraced by the German right and treated by the German right as one of them. He brought his Nazi party into the anti-reparations coalition. Hugenberg gave him columns and columns and columns and inches, column inches. He gave them column inches and column inches and column inches of press and making Adolf Hitler as the new face of the German right. Post-Young Referendum, you can't call the Nazi Party a left-wing organization. No German believed it, no European believed it, no American should believe it. But that sort of distortion that Helena talks about, yes, that is rampant among the American right wing. The sense that they don't really have to deal with the Nazis because the Nazis really aren't conservatives. William F. Buckley did a column in 1998 on anti-Semitism where he tried to read anti-Semitism out of the conservative movement. And he addressed some of these matters. He said, look, these are people we have praised before. He wasn't necessarily referring to the Nazis. He was referring to Joe Sobert and other folks. He said, these are people we have praised before. We have to stop praising them now. Sadly, a lot of what William F. Buckley wrote has been forgotten by the conservative movement, by the Republicans, especially more so than the conservatives of 2017. And that's painful to see.
All right. So what I wanted to say is regarding this fallout and these corporate boards and all these people resigning from them, I think the most ironic thing is that those corporate boards themselves, I think, is one of the most fascist things I've ever heard of. So I say good riddance because
interesting.
I think
as
I
an
think,
economist, you fell that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I
how,
think that,
how is,
I,
how is, isn't that, that the free economy?
No,
that's rank corporatism.
No.
Rank
yeah, it's right. Right.
Right.
Having big business in bed with big government is like my nightmare. So good. I am glad.
Oh,
you know,
interesting.
It makes you feel better.
I want that out.
It, It is an ironic benefit. It is an ironic benefit of this disaster.
One of them, at least, maybe manufacturing, never met. So the big business, the big government wasn't happening.
The Arts Council, which sent this big letter that said we're no longer going to meet with you.
That's notable President Trump, the difference in numbers of CEOs who have stepped down versus participants in the Evangelical Council. I know I went on an endless rant on this last week, and I'll do it again this week. I think evangelicals should be beyond ashamed of themselves. They should have been ashamed of themselves long before October, long before the video, long before all of that. One technically stepped down, A.R. Bernard, who is a Black pastor. Not that that should really matter, but he had actually stepped down a couple of months ago, I believe, but I don't think that was publicized. And he wrote some sort of letter making clear that he was going to distance himself put distance between himself and the president. So I continue to be incredibly disappointed. I continue to be saddened and disheartened by the way that the evangelical community has chosen to respond to this administration.
Helena, would that include Jerry Falwell Jr.'s bizarre doubling down?
Don't.
I've opened the door, Helena. Walk right through. Walk through the door.
How do I say this?
Yeah, please.
To me and to many evangelicals we know, and I don't want to make this a statement on a person's individual relationship with the Lord. I don't know Jerry Falwell personally. I never met him, never met his son. They don't count.
Oh boy.
If that makes sense. it's sort of like if you're a vegan who eats steak, right? If you're like, no, I'm a vegan, but I eat steak. I like a good filet mignon. That's fine. You can call yourself a vegan, but being a vegan means something. You know, the way C.S. Lewis put it is there are words that have a particular meaning, and those meanings get distorted because just anyone assumes a label. And so, you know, again, this is not a statement as to whether Jerry Falwell is a Christian. I don't know. I don't know him. That's between him and God. Matthew chapter 7 has a lot to say about people who think they're Christians and they're actually not. And I don't say this from judgment. I say this from, like, figure it out. I'm the worst of them. But he doesn't count. He just, you know, when people blather on with the kind of ugliness and, you know, whatnot that you see here, they don't count. If someone's going to show up at a KKK rally and chant blood and soil with a tiki torch from Lowe's, you're not a Christian. You can call yourself one. That's fine. It doesn't change the fact that you're not. And you'll find that out one day. So that's my very humble response to Jerry Falwell.
I should note that we have no evidence that the tiki torches actually came from Lowe's. Right. Just to be clear here.
Correct. And
if anyone from Lowe's is listening, don't have your lawyer sue us. We don't know that they were from Lowe's.
Yeah, or if Home Depot was thinking of advertising on the podcast, please.
At Home Depot is fine. Home Depot is fine. I will say Lowe's customer service a little bit better, but, you know.
Oh, okay.
Hey, now we're getting controversial.
Oh, boy. So I wanted to bring up where we go from here with this movement of taking things down, because in addition to the rally in Boston for free speech or versus anti-hate, there were also a number, at least in my city and some others, for taking things down, like statues of Columbus being, you know, Columbus, Ohio, and also in Detroit, Michigan. And you know, so again, that somewhat of why Trump might have gotten some accolades from some people on Tuesday is because they were concerned that it would lead to these kind of whitewashing of history.
Accolades might be too strong a word, but you mean he wasn't condemned by everybody?
Well,
I mean
the two-thirds of people who supported what he said on
the two-thirds of Republicans
two-thirds
who supported
of
what he
self-identified
said.
Republicans who supported what he said.
I actually had a post on this on Monuments Blur, the Confederate monuments on the More Perfect Union podcast website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com, if you want to see it.
And I totally agree with everything you said in that. In this, hey, geography, I understand that argument, but now we're starting to see things like, again, close to me, there was a monument of, in a historical home of a birthplace of the Confederate general. And it's a marker that he was born there. That he, you know, everybody's born. That's
but here's the thing.
Honor, you know,
I was just going to say, here's the thing. People like me would come to the defense and say, that's appropriate. So why not have these conversations? And yes, there will be instances where, as a society, we may err too far in one direction and we may have to rebalance it a little bit. But is it the conversation healthy to have?
Then I agree with that.
Yes.
I agree. Things are contextual. And then somebody was saying that, like, the Knights of Columbus should be ashamed of themselves because Columbus was such a bad guy. And again, so I did some reading on it. And the context was at the time, at the turn of the 20th century, when the Knights of Columbus was formed, Italian Catholics were horribly, horribly discriminated against. And this was like a finger in the eye of their WASP oppressors, is why they embraced Columbus. Like, hey, we're the Knights of Columbus because our guy was here on this hemisphere before you were. And so, you know, you put that in the context, and people are trying to ascribe modern day values to historical events.
Well, look, at the end of the day, every statue will suffer the same fate as that of Ozymandias. We all understand that. The question is, what do we in 2017 choose to venerate and revere? And that's what statues are. Statues are not about remembrance. They're about reverence. So do we choose to revere a president who spent 8 years blasting fiscal sanity, blasting monetary stability, and killing as many Native Americans as he could just to get them out of Tennessee and northern Georgia and Alabama and northern Mississippi? I would say no. Pull down every single Andrew Jackson statue that we can find and recycle that stuff for other things. Other people may disagree. We can have that discussion.
I'm going to push back a little bit. I was just reading this column by Peggy Noonan talking about the statue of Oliver Cromwell. And since you're our Anglophile, maybe in Parliament, and that while Cromwell did some really, really terrible things, in fact, he was so bad that such a dictator that upon his death, they decided to go back to the monarchy. His statue hangs in Parliament because it's part of the story and becoming a
but that's more
parliamentary
of a historical
government.
Place. It's more of a museum.
Excuse me, Greg. This is now personal history because my family is Northern Irish Catholic. Again, tear Oliver Cromwell down.
Interesting.
I am not a fan of. I am not a fan of Cromwell. Not a fan of Cromwell at all.
I read they dug him up and beheaded him after his natural death. So that's not enough.
And
we also have to tear down the statue.
But again, these are the kind of discussions we should have, because the fact of the matter is none of these statues or none of these erections were put place when these people were alive. They were done generations after they were gone, and mainly they were put by people who were trying to impose their historiography on the past anyway. We have just as much right to determine what 2017 should venerate as they had to determine what 1800, 1900, 1950 or whatever should venerate. That is our call. And while we may want to take into account what those folks back then were thinking, you know, particularly regarding, say, the Knights of Columbus, if that name was designed as a reaction to the WASP treatment of Italian Americans, and yes, we take that into account. But in terms of, say, the Confederate statues, or even in terms of, say, the statues to Andrew Jackson, which were mainly designed to tell my great-great-great-great-grandfather, you know, the Karl Rove of the Whig Party, Thurlow Weed, to stuff it. So obviously I have some personal issues with Andrew Jackson, too. I'll admit to that. You know, we have that right to make our own decisions. I would say most Americans, if they looked at John Adams versus Thomas Jefferson, I would hope to say that most Americans would say that the former is a far better politician than the latter. Maybe I'm deluding myself. That's fine. But if I am right about that, then we should see fewer statues to Jefferson and more statues to John Adams. That should not be as controversial as it is now.
So let's talk about this. We've covered a lot of what happened in terms of the monuments, in terms of the press conference, in terms of the alt-right, the alt-left, and the Arts Council and the Business Council. But there is something else that came up this week that's a little lighter in note and yet worthy of discussion, which is that the president has decided he will
He will skip the Kennedy Center honors. Greg, how do you feel about this? I know that you, you're an artist in your own right. You're a musician. How do you feel about the president deciding that the Kennedy Center honors are not for him this year?
Look, I should be shocked. This should really upset me. The fact that the president has duties and responsibilities, but this is the first time he was supposed to be at the foreign press
correspondence
dinner, and he didn't, because they knew he'd make fun of him. And here we have a group of artists, Lionel Richie's going to be there, by the way, one of the best concerts I've ever been to. Kevin's agreeing with me. It really was, and I'm honest about that, one of the best concerts I've ever been to. And he knows that there's 5 people being honored this year. Every one of them, and everyone who's paid tribute to these performers, will stop and say, by the way, President Trump, you're a terrible person. By the way, President Trump, Nazis are bad. By the way, President Trump, I hate your tie. And so on throughout the night. It will be worse than the correspondence dinner, especially with the racial climate, especially with what's going on, probably with what's his announcements in Afghanistan tomorrow. And he's not that thick-skinned enough. So I should be shocked, but I'm not.
Well, it would have been a great sight to see him pinning a Medal of Freedom or whatever it is that they give the Kennedy Center honorees around Norman Lear's neck.
Oh, I know.
That would have been – oh, God, that would have been wonderful.
It's actually a necklace.
Yeah.
It's a very large necklace.
With a medallion of some kind, yes.
With a giant medallion, yeah. I don't think he really cares about that kind of stuff. And like I said, I should be surprised, but I'm not. And I think that all that stuff, that presidential stuff that we loved, like, oh my gosh, this is like the presidential awards and he's going to be here. It's kind of ruined from here on out, because the next president, if he doesn't show up, we'll be like, eh, who cares? This is just sort of something that doesn't happen anymore.
To be clear, and somebody did this research and put it in front of us on the monitor, Trump is going to be the 4th president to skip the Kennedy Center honors. Bill Clinton missed them because he was in Budapest for a conference.
Yeah, the Iran-Contra scandal. Yeah.
The Iran-Contra scandal kept Jimmy Carter away. George H.W. Bush missed it because he was meeting with Gorbachev in Malta.
Which was funny, because I did see something reported a couple days ago that this had never happened before, and then I saw today that it posted that this was actually the 4th time.
Anytime we hear like that Trump, and we had this with Obama, anytime we heard this has never happened, and we saw this with Obama, a president has never put his feet up on the Oval Office desk.
A tan suit in September.
Right.
That's my favorite.
And never saluted them with his coffee in his hand.
Or he's never done this. We always found out it wasn't true.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's just now. He just doesn't want to go. He likes to stay home at night. He doesn't like to go out.
He's so widely disliked, right? And it's a hostile audience, the same way White House correspondence is a hostile audience. And to me, you know, one thing, maybe it's wishful thinking, but one thing this week has raised is questions about 2020. We've always, you know, I know the joke every week is this is his worst week yet. I think this really was the worst week yet after the Billy Bush tape. And it makes me wonder, you know, what's going to happen in terms of people circling the wagons for 2020. I would be shocked if he ends up getting the nomination again without any issue. Yeah, I'd
really
be shocked.
Oh, without
and here's
any
why.
Issue.
Here's but- why. Let me just say this real quick, DJ. The reason why is, you know, the GOP, McConnell, Ryan, et cetera, made a Faustian deal with him under the assumption that they could get their legislative agenda taken care of with Trump in office. They couldn't do it with, you know, crooked Hillary, as he calls her. And that was the deal they were willing to make. And now that they're seeing that not only can they not accomplish the agenda, their agenda is in peril, right? The agenda is never talked about. They never get through. It's not worth it. It's not worth it anymore, especially if you can get to his floor, right? He has a floor in terms of what he, how many people he can afford to lose. If they can get to the floor and be confident that they could put up a Kasich, I don't know, a Romney, I don't know, someone else without losing too many voters, you know.
Oh, but Kasich.
Oh, well, yeah. I was going to say he had no presence,
Kasich,
but, you know.
Kasich is such an asshole.
I'm nice.
Oh, I was going to say asshole.
I mean, I'm not as angry at John Kasich as Greg is, but John Kasich is never taking the nomination away from Donald Trump. I'd like it to happen. I think he'd be a much better standard bearer for the party, but it is never going to happen.
I think there's a list of people who could, you know, if the party does what the Democratic Party did in 2016, and if they elbow everyone out and say, sit down, we're going to all circle around so-and-so, we're not going to split the vote 17 ways this time. I think it could happen. I think it should happen. I think that the worst thing that ever happened to the Republican Party is this election. I think it would have been far better for Republicans.
Yeah, I would love for them to circle, have a bunch of old rich white guys come in and say, you know what? You're not getting what you want. Really? Yep, you're not getting it because we're going to give this rich white guy what he wants. What? But Daddy said I was going to be president. Sorry, you're just going to have to be a team. What?
No, I object to the whole rich white guy thing. The primary options for the GOP were much more diverse. You know, than the Democratic Party this year.
Okay, putting Greg and Kevin to one side, I actually was part of the Republican nomination process, so I think I have a little bit more knowledge on this than either the two of them.
You do. You do.
Helena, how do you account for the fact that so many Republican establishment officials, when they had the opportunity to prevent a Trump nomination, kept telling everybody that Ted Cruz was scarier than Donald Trump?
Yeah. So here's why.
How do you deal with that?
Ted Cruz, up until 10 minutes ago, was an ideologue, right? The leadership of the Republican Party, they don't want someone with principles. No offense. They don't want someone who's going to rigidly adhere to a set of values that Ted Cruz once had pre his Trump endorsement. And that's why they thought that Trump would be easier to deal with. He's malleable, right? He doesn't actually care about any position he takes. I think they believe if they tell him, look, this is the party line, we put you up, we need you to get behind it, that he would just do it. And honestly, to a large extent, that's probably right. But for the insanity and the distractions and this alt-right wing that has come out of the presidency, I think that could have been true. I think if they could do it over again, no doubt would they go behind Ted Cruz. No doubt. I think. I could be wrong. You could disagree.
I don't know. I still don't think they thought that Ted Cruz could win. And they thought that their only chance to beat Hillary Clinton, with infrastructure being in place and what it is, was somebody different, somebody entertaining, somebody from TV.
And the fact of the matter is
when these people look to 2020, and I dealt with these people inside the Republican Party for 25 years, so I like to think I know a little something about them. The fact of the matter is they will rationalize to themselves that it is better to fall in behind the incumbent, that in a second term, presidents don't pay as much attention and the staff can have greater import. They will rationalize supporting Trump's renomination and reelection, just as they have rationalized largely refusing to abandon Trump now. They've criticized him for Tuesday. There's been some blowback on that. Yes, that's true. But the kind of mass defection from Donald Trump that those of us outside the Republican Party seem to think is going to happen any day now, it is never going to happen. Donald Trump is the president. He is the incumbent. He is the overwhelming favorite for renomination. And the dangerous thing for – hang on, Helena. The dangerous thing, the thing that Democrats have to realize is that because Donald Trump is the incumbent, he is also the favorite for reelection in 2020 until proven otherwise. And it's not been proven otherwise. We have work to do on our side.
So there's a lot of statistics and trends that we tend to see around incumbents and how incumbents are treated. And the one lesson we took away from 2016 is trends and pundits are wrong. This is a candidate unlike anyone else. I think the same's going to happen in 2020. I have to believe, just so I can sleep at night and not live in constant fear of North Korea, et cetera, I have to believe that the people who run this country, that McConnell, Ryan, the adults, I should say, who run the country, are intelligent enough to recognize that to back Trump in 2020 and to keep moving this train forward would be the end of the Republican Party for a generation. I have to believe that they recognize that.
Okay, Helena, weren't those the same people that you thought did you not have to believe that they had a functioning replacement for Obamacare in place and ready to go this year?
Look, that
have
that
they
I
not disappointed you
that
enough?
I understand. They're prepared to be an opposition party. They have no idea how to be a governing party. That's fine. That I can understand, right? But here we are talking about what does
I can't understand that at all.
I'm not shocked, right? But this if they put the stake in the heart of the Republican Party for the next generation by getting behind him again and forever ruining for people under, I don't know, 50 or whatever, what it means to be a Republican. No, I can't believe that. I refuse to believe that. I will hold on to this this belief of mine until 2020.
And in June of 2020,
you can pull this out and be like, Elena, you're wrong.
Has the delegates to win renomination? We will revisit this conversation.
Yes, and I will weep. I will weep.
Right now, let's visit the last topic of this show, which is a press conference that's going to happen after we tape this. That I believe Donald Trump is planning to have Monday night about his plan going forward on Afghanistan. So there's a lot of ways this could go. I want to go around the round table, starting with, I'm going to start with Molly, because we haven't heard from her in a little while. Molly, what do you think is going to be the outcome of that? I mean, I guess there's only three or four possibilities. Why don't you outline the possibilities and then tell us what you think is going to happen?
Okay, so what could happen is that he's going to announce that there's going to be more troops, fewer troops, like a drawdown. Roughly the same amount of troops, but moving towards privatization. But what I want to predict is going to happen is I think there will be more troops, a la a surge type. Not sure whether it will go the privatization route, but mostly I think that while it's ostensibly a press conference to talk about Afghanistan, I think the real point is for him to have a chance to start off with like a do-over and make some comments about Charlottesville again that are scripted. And I think that his handlers, that's why they have organized this. So that's my prediction.
So you think it's going to go off the rails early?
Well, I don't think that's the plan. I think, again, it's scripted. Like somebody made the point that he needs to stop talking about race at all when he does not have a teleprompter in front of him. And, you know, maybe this is how it starts.
Greg, what do you see happening?
Yeah, I agree with Molly that he will not take questions. I mean, it will be he'll sit there like a fifth grader reading an oral report. Airplanes have four major components. See illustration. Wait, I wasn't supposed to copy that. And he will not take questions. But I think yes, there will be more. But I mean, I think he's going to follow the GW. I think he's like Halliburton, where all the real money is, and somehow he's going to say, you know, how do I get a Halliburton type contract? And he's like trying to figure out how he can make some real money, and that's why he sent the Kush out there to scope out some. When this all comes out, like in 100 years, and the documents are unsealed, it'll be like, Kush set up Kusha Burton or something like that, and we're all gonna be like, oh, they made billions off this war. So, yeah, that's what it's
about. Helena, what do you think?
I think it's gonna be more troops. You know, Bannon is out. Bannon fought the military's recommendation for an increase in troops. Fought it pretty hard, and he's not there anymore. I think one thing we can be confident about is Donald Trump himself probably doesn't have a strong view one way or another as to what ought to happen. And whoever's speaking loudest in his ear and last in his ear right before the press conference is probably going to win, which is why I think the military here is going to win and they're going to get more troops.
DJ?
I think there will be more troops involved. I think there will be a higher profile for contractor support, as we would call it in the DOD. I was a contractor there for many years. That's what we called ourselves, contract support. But there will be, I think, a greater military presence. Trump will try some sort of fig leaf about resource seizure or something like that. I fear that there is not going to be much of a strategy at all beyond increased troop deployment. There's not going to be any sort of discussion about reconciliation between the Pashtun tribes and everyone else in the large and diverse anti-Taliban coalition in Afghanistan. There's not going to be much discussion about how to rebuild Afghanistan's political culture, because Donald Trump doesn't care about political culture. He's just going to throw more troops at the problem and hope it goes away. And it's not going to go away, because the basis of what's called neoconservatism, the democratic peace theory, which is that it is harder for democracies to be at war with each other, is anathema to this administration. This administration prefers strongmen to democracies, and that is going to continue to handicap us and damage us. And I think that will also be the case with Afghanistan.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that we're going to know as little about our Afghanistan policy on Tuesday morning as we know about it now. I think he's going to come out with some platitudes about having a strong foreign policy, maybe try to lay out some form of a Trump doctrine that no one will understand. I do believe privatization is going to be built in there, because they don't want to take official losses. They want to be able to say that they're cutting back on, you know, they're not following what Obama did there. So they're not going to double down on a surge, I don't think. But I think it's going to be a convoluted exercise. It's really not going to tell us anything, but he'll probably look very presidential doing it. That's my guess.
I don't think it'll look presidential doing it, but the rest I would agree with you, Kevin.
Okay, and last thing, where's everybody going to be during the eclipse on Monday?
Protect your dogs. I have to say, important public service announcement. Protect your dogs. Either get them eclipse glasses, which you can, I don't know, maybe rush and get on Amazon, or keep them indoors, because you don't want them to look at the sun and burn out their eyes.
Good point.
I just got some glasses, but I'll be looking at the sun with my daughters, which I did get glasses while I was in Chicago at the Adler Planetarium, because I'm smart like that. I like to drop names. So
our local COSI, you know, the Center of Science and Industry in Columbus is pairing with all the local libraries and Metro Parks and having an event where they're passing out glasses. And my daughter is not yet back in school, so I'm going to take her. My son is back in school, so his physics teacher is taking them out to see it, and they have some kind of mechanism for making sure that they're safe.
And DJ?
I will be staring at my computer screen because I will be working.
There you go. And all I can say is, again, I make this reference every show, but being a little bit older than everybody here, all I can say is I can't tell you how many times in my life they've told me that something's going to happen that's a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and they seem to happen every 8 to 10 years. So I'm sure it's going to be spectacular. Right. I'm not going to be looking at it with or without glasses. I'll probably be looking at MSNBC. Because that's what I tend to do on Mondays. And with that, I want to thank
Kevin, it's
going
to be on MSNBC.
To this show. Yeah, that's true. And I'll probably burn out my eyes looking at that. please follow us on Twitter at MPU Podcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/MorePerfectUnionPodcast and share our link on your Facebook timeline so your friends can discover us as well. And if you would like to join our political debate between shows, join us in our Facebook group, Open Fire Politics, which just hit 8,700 members in less than 3 years. We're going to hit 9,000 this week. You could be the 9,000th member. So come join today. We're all there. We'd love to see you there, too. Any last thoughts about where we've been as a group, where we're going as a nation?
Do you think the eclipse has anything like to do with Donald Trump? Like this is a sign from the ancients? Like this is the worst president. Everyone like this is the solar.
He's so bad that the sun will be blotted out
from the sky. Right, the universe is telling us how bad he is.
Given that the last eclipse was during the Carter administration, Greg may have a point.